What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
People say, if you don't love America, then get the hell out. Well, I love America. We love the people of America very much, but when it comes to the government, it stops right there. The government is a bunch of corrupt thieves. They are rapists and robbers.
Dear circa 1989 Oliver Stone, the good news, 27 years later, you're still making movies. The bad news, you're still pretty sure the government is corrupt.
That's actually bad news for America, not just for Oliver Stone.
Back in 89, the director of the just-released Snowden won a Best Directing Oscar for Born on the 4th of July. Tom Cruise, in the clip you heard there, as Vietnam vet turned anti-war protester Ron Kovic.
On this week's show, we consider both Stones, the 80s Oscar winner and today's older, maybe slightly less edgy, provocateur. Plus, critic and author Matt Zoller-Seitz talks about his new book, The Oliver Stone Experience. That and even more ahead on Film Spotting.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans.
That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Josh, last week, of course, we talked about the new Clint Eastwood film, Sully. Like the two films we're going to talk about on this week's show, a movie based on a true story, a biopic of sorts. We got into a little bit of a tiff about that one. We'll have a couple of chances this week to get into another row, but I'm going to go out on a limb that we're probably not going to disagree too violently over Born on the 4th of July or Snowden.
I don't know. Once you disagree about something as mild-mannered and innocuous as Sully.
See, I take offense at the use of the phrase mild-mannered. It suggests the movie is milquetoast, Josh, and it is not.
I just kept picturing Sully himself, you know, so calm, watching us and just shaking his head.
I think I could watch that.
I'm sure you'd love it.
I'm pretty sure
he's just doing his job.
Later in the show, Matt Zoller-Seitz, someone we've wanted on the show for a very long time, is going to come on. He's going to challenge the Warren Commission's single bullet theory of Oliver Stone's career. He's got a new book out called The Oliver Stone Experience. So he's going to share his top five Oliver Stone moments. Settle in. There is a lot of show ahead.
First, though, Born on the 4th of July was Oliver Stone's second tour of duty to Vietnam as a filmmaker. Now, some 27 years later, he gets his first Film Spotting Sacred Cow review.
My brother's up at school to Delphi,
yeah.
And he said that there's going to be a big war over there in, what is it?
Vietnam.
And he said that the Marines are going to be the first ones in and ain't going to last too long.
That's right. So if we don't sign up soon, we're going to miss it. I've already decided I'm going in.
Really?
Just like that?
Yeah. I'm not waiting. I'm going in now.
Come on, man. Are you crazy?
No, you're crazy. Our dad's got to go to WW2. This is our chance to do something. To be part of history, guys.
Yeah. Just like our dads.
There's going to be a lot of Oliver Stone talk on this show, Adam, and rightfully so. As we get into our Sacred Cow review of Born on the 4th of July, I'm sure we'll put the movie in the context of his career, especially in terms of how it presents what might be called Oliver Stone's America. But I'd like to start with Tom Cruise, who stars here as Ron Kovic, the real-life Vietnam vet who jumped at the chance to fight out of high school, came home paralyzed from a bullet wound, and would go on to become a leading voice for veterans against the war. We should also note that Kovic and Stone wrote the screenplay together and were nominated for an Academy Award. Watching the movie again for the first time since the 1990s, it was fascinating to consider Cruise's performance in light of where his career has gone since, and to remember what it meant for him to take on the role in 1989. This was just a few years after his breakout in Top Gun, which, as Matt Zoller-Seitz notes in his book, is the anti-Born on the 4th of July. I remember thinking when I first saw Born that this was a clearly calculated bid on Cruise's part for industry respect, and he was nominated for his first Oscar. But watching the movie now, it struck me how perfect he not only was for the part, but also how it brilliantly subverts the Tom Cruise persona. I don't know if it's his best performance or his favorite of mine, to tease the multi-worded poll question about Denzel Washington we have going on at filmspotting.net, but I think it might be his definitive one. Would you put Cruise's performance in any of those three categories?
Wow, so much to dive into there and so much to answer. It's, of course, not an entirely fair question, because when has Tom Cruise really ever been bad? There are some movies he's made that I don't really appreciate and some just kind of okay stuff. But you look back over his 45 credits on IMDb, and there are a lot of good movies and a lot of good performances, even if some of them are very similar, playing the Ethan Hunt type of character in a variety of different spy or action thrillers.
He's not generally the problem with the movie.
No, he's never the problem. And no, I have not seen all of Far and Away, so you're not going to hear me ripping on his Irish accent here. But if you look back at that list, you see movies like Risky Business, All the Right Moves, Top Gun, Color of Money, Cocktail early on. He basically got by on his charm and his movie star charisma, his great looks. And then it's 88, 89 with Rain Man and Born on the Fourth back to back, where he does probably really blossom into an actor as far as tackling more challenging material. It's also not an entirely fair question, because I haven't been rewatching a bunch of Tom Cruise movies in preparation for this week. And Born on the Fourth of July is, of course, freshest in my mind. But right now, I certainly have it in the conversation and maybe even a little bit ahead of Eyes Wide Shut, Magnolia, Jerry Maguire, when I think about my favorite Tom Cruise performances, because he really was the biggest surprise for me with this film this time around. Mm. And I've seen parts of it over the years, but I think we mentioned this maybe when we were teasing the show a few weeks back. I saw Born on the Fourth a few years after it came out. I saw it in 91 or 92 on home video.
Yeah, that was probably my experience too.
Haven't seen it since, but I remembered the sheer power of Stone's filmmaking. I didn't remember just how powerful Cruise was. I think here Stone was able to take this big screen presence and his occasional manic kind of energy and maybe not contain it, but channel it. I think about a scene early in the movie in the Massapequa sequence where he is in a big wrestling match. It's this character's first experience with failure, and that battle between success and failure is a big theme in this movie. And I think he's behind at one point. The match is kind of coming to an end. He's got to make something happen. And just before he gets into position, you see Cruise circling and he's pumping his arms. He's trying to psych himself up in this very kind of highly masculine moment. And then later when he loses, it's not just himself he's letting down. We see the disappointment in his mother's face, who, oh, by the way, earlier tells one son, look at Ronnie. It's not about success. It's only about whether or not you try your best. We see the look on her face. Stone's camera shows us that close-up. It's not about whether you try your best. She can't believe that he lost and is disappointed that he lost. So that's just one of those many lies that comes up, or if you want to put it a little more nicely, one of those contradictions that he and many American kids at the time were raised with. But we also see the coach's disappointment, the father's, his teammates. Donna, played by Kira Sedgwick, who's kind of his love interest from the time he's a little kid, only seems to really feel some empathy for him in that situation. But I think about that scene and Cruise and that energy, and I think about later when he's sitting in the school gym and Tom Berenger comes to recruit. And having seen Platoon and loved that movie, I remember loving the fact that it was Barnes. Sergeant Barnes comes to recruit Tom Cruise. We get a shot of Cruise's face in the crowd sitting with his schoolmates that's really similar to the shot of him sitting with the other pilots in the first meeting at Top Gun. And I know this because I've seen Top Gun approximately 237 times. There's even similar lines, Josh. In Top Gun, the commanding officer, played by Tom Skerritt, says, in case some of you wonder who the best is, they're on this plaque. You think you'll be on that plaque? And he says, yes, sir. Well, we get Berenger's Marine up there saying to this group, not everybody becomes a United States Marine. We want the best, and we'll accept nothing but the best. But everything about the way Cruise plays Maverick, even just his posture, suggests cockiness and this attitude that he's the best already. The Navy needs him more than he might need the Navy. And then you contrast that with how he plays Ron Kovic, and the way he sits in that crowd and looks up at Berenger, it suggests a sense of admiration, a call to service and sacrifice, this belief in a higher calling, a belief that only the Marines and proving himself in war can make him the best American and the best American man he can be. And not really a zealot, though. That's what I love so much about the performance. He doesn't have that blank look on his face like his mother has every time she starts really getting going about God. he's just an idealist. And so there are a lot of wonderful scenes in this movie, a lot of wonderful Cruise moments in this movie, but maybe the standout one for me is when he says to his father during the whole breakdown just before he goes off to Mexico, the big fight that night when he comes home drunk, he says, "Who's going to love me?" You have to credit, of course, Cruise, but Stone and Kovic on the script. But I think that moment really crystallizes what is the central struggle of this movie, what his as a character central struggle is. He's feeling betrayed by his government, sure, by his fellow citizens who don't care about him and the sacrifice he made. And then, of course, he's just dealing with that daily struggle of being paralyzed. But he had this idealized image of the American male that he was trying to live up to. And he was loved because he was everybody's Yankee Doodle boy, as his mother calls him at one point. You take that away, he's got no more sense of identity, no sense of himself as a man, and nobody who will love him like a man. It's a heartbreaking moment. Cruise delivers it perfectly. And that real sense of how broken Ron Kovic is as a man, how desperate he is at times, and just that real vulnerability was something that comes through in Cruise's performance that I didn't remember at all, didn't take in or appreciate the first time I saw Born on the 4th of July.
Yeah, I think I was just too skeptical of it at the time as being an Oscar bid, and what those often are will involve deprettifying yourself, right? If you're a handsome actor like Cruise is. And that's not what's going on here. And it has a lot for me to do with the physicality of this performance. Cruise is first and foremost a physical performer. And we think of, you know, people talk and joke about the way he runs. And it's just so defined in our consciousness, that one action that he performs. I think of him as like, he's like a bullet that's searching for a Kevlar vest to hit. He's just unstoppable, right? Yeah. And here's a kid early on, those were what his other characters were. But here's a kid who was unstoppable in the same way and not only gets stopped, but gets stopped and cut short too soon. Mm-hmm. And the other interesting thing about this performance is how the physicality doesn't disappear after he is paralyzed. It morphs, and you still sense not only the Ron Kovic that is there, but also the Tom Cruise persona that is there. And this is all encapsulated. The scene for me in terms of Cruise's performance occurs at the VA hospital. After he's been there a while, it's a nightmarish, decrepit place, really rough sequence in the film. But he's going to get out of there. And not only that, he's going to walk out of there. He's mm-hmm. been told there's no chance that you can walk again by doctors. And we see this sequence that in a traditional Tom Cruise movie would end in victory, where he's in crutches, dragging himself. His fellow patients are cheering him on, "Go, Ronnie, go, Ronnie." But we notice that all he's doing in this montage is getting better and more muscular at dragging his mm-hmm. dead legs. And Cruise's Kovic doesn't acknowledge that.
No.
He's convincing himself.
The whole movie is about the stories you tell yourself.
That he is that he is going to walk again. And of course, this is the scene where it does eventually end in a fall. That's disastrous for him. So yeah, I really was taken aback by Cruise's performance here, and then the intricacy of the way he uses his own physicality to carry it all the way through the movie.
His face too. He's really subtle in the way he uses it in close-ups.
We don't
get that overly manic Cruise at all.
No, not at all. And in that auditorium you were talking about where he and his friends are listening to the Marine recruiter, his face there, it's not exactly the cocky Top Gun because it's different. There, you know, he's there to show off. In Born on the 4th of July, he's here to claim his birthright.
Yeah.
And it's the manliness aspect to me mm-hmm. that really came through in this viewing as well. This idea of taking apart a mid-century vision of masculinity is what the entire Born on the 4th of July does. And if you look at this opening sequence before Ron goes to war, it establishes what manhood is supposed to mean for him. Mm-hmm. And there seem to be four qualities. There's physicality, which Cruise embodies. There's violence, which wrestling also embodies. Mm-hmm. Think about how his coach tells him, go out there and kill.
You have to destroy them.
Kill,
he's like a drill sergeant.
Exactly. There is also victory. That comes into play with wrestling and later when he hits the home run. And then there's the admiration of women. That's the fourth component, to be a real man. And it's interesting how Stone in these early scenes combines all those. Mm-hmm. So his two instances of violence and physicality and potential victory, we see girls watching. And Ron notices that too, right?
Yeah.
And what happens when he goes to war and is injured? all of that, all four of those things are systematically taken away from him. And the second half of the film tragically charts each of that. And I felt like this was something going on almost in the background of Born on the 4th of July, where in the foreground is the deconstruction of American iconography, the parade it opens with, and how we can already sense something's off in that parade.
Breaking down those myths.
It's kind of the more bludgeoning Oliver Stone is breaking down those myths. But this deconstruction of manhood, I really appreciated that was going on in the background.
Yeah, you're right. It's absolutely there. And in some cases, it's definitely in the foreground, like in that scene with his father, where, of course, now he, to go to the bathroom, uses a catheter, right? And so it's almost like he's engaging with his son in a very private type of act, but we know that he isn't the masculine ideal below the waist that he wants to be, and he laments that at certain points throughout the movie. It's interesting that you point out how he notices girls and the way they see him or are watching, but that's just another element of his personal sacrifice, right? He puts off going to the prom. He doesn't get the date he wanted, but he doesn't try to go with anybody else. Even in that early kiss with Donna as a young boy, the first thing he wants to do after the kiss is show her how many push-ups he can do, right? So he just doesn't seem interested, whereas she's interested in this romantic, ideal moment, and he doesn't give it to her. And then, like I said, he basically avoids any type of female relationship. And that's why there's another scene later in the film, as we talk about manhood, where he has what the movie suggests anyway is his first sexual encounter. And let's go back to these ideals of that mid-century romantic ideal of sex and love and marriage. The first woman he has sex with, he basically wants to buy her a ring and marry her.
Yeah.
He thinks that that's the next step. Like, he's found her.
Even though this is in Mexico at a brothel.
Like, he did pay her the money. But again, he's constructed this myth that she cares about him.
Well, that's a very interesting filmed scene. Tender, that's the word for it. That's Stone conducts
that. She loves him.
Very romantically. And contrasts it later with another similar scene that goes horribly wrong at a brothel. And so I was thinking about that. Is this Stone just putting us more in his head, or did he happen to find this one woman who actually isn't just doing her job but might care for him a little bit? He kind of mixes those messages in a way that does allow us to see why he might propose.
Yeah,
he's just trying to almost – recreate the nuclear family.
Right.
This is where you would start if he's trying to return back to that ideal of what it means to be an American male.
And that moment when she comes down the brothel stairs and they lock eyes like something out of a 1950s movie, contrast that with how she looks the next time he sees her, the next night or whatever it is, where she looks like what you would expect to find in a dirty Mexican brothel. Did she look like that the night before too?
Right.
And somehow he chose to see her that way? You don't really know, but look, from the opening sequence of this movie, that pre-credits and that credit sequence, I remember in 91 and 92 being stunned by it and just wowed by the filmmaking, and I was here as well. The camera, at times, it's hard not to watch these scenes that take place in Texas on these summer days back in the 50s and not think a little bit of The Tree of Life and Terrence Malick, but the camera, even though it's moving in both films, it's always active. There's something just so much more frenetic and maybe angry about the camera in Born on the 4th of July. Stone is not only always moving the camera, but he's cutting on action. So it gives it all this very fragmented, disjointed kind of sense to it. And that really doesn't stop until he's in high school and he goes to meet with the Marines. Like when he finally has the gym recruiting session, that's where we know that this is really important to him, and the movie focuses on him and his reaction to that.
The parade sequence is purposefully working against itself in so many ways. You have patriotic colors, but they're maybe oversaturated a little bit. And you also have kids running in and out, but it's not – it is more like the sort of camera work that would follow soldiers in a chaotic battle scene as these kids run in and out of their parents in the crowd.
Yeah, it's not realism.
Then it is – no, and it's – but
overhead
it's not like
shots
Malick
when
is a
war.
Good – comparison, because it's not like a floating Malick following these kids being free ethereal beings. They're frantic and antic, and the sounds, the off-screen sounds of gunfire or caps that echo gunfire, it's a very jarring sequence.
Yeah, it is, and I think it totally works how heightened it is, because the movie does open, and I think it's the only bit we get in the movie with Ron Kovic's voiceover.
It was a long time ago. Sometimes I can still hear their voices across Sally's woods. There was Billy, Steve, Tommy, and the tall kid from down the street, Joey. Yeah, it was Joey Walsh. And my best friend was Timmy Burns, who lived two blocks away from me. And we'd turn the woods into a battlefield and dream that someday we would become men.
This is Cruz Kovic looking back on his childhood, this idealized version of his childhood. It is full of these moments where they're playing war. They are hitting the home run at the Little League game. It's full of parades and fireworks and first kisses, all these sort of classic American tropes. It's only missing the apple pie, and maybe that's snuck in somewhere. But it is his recollection of his childhood. He's viewing it, I think, through this nostalgic glow. I think we all do that. I know I romanticized even my own childhood growing up. But then that is balanced or juxtaposed, right, with these shots of the World War II veteran with no arms during the parade, who gives that look, that glance, that he doesn't take his eyes off young Ronnie, the same way older Ronnie is going to look at a young kid with a Yankees ball cap on when he's in his parade. And then how about, sort of like with the Mexican prostitute, the different way Massapequa appears when we see it in 55 and 65 or whatever, and then when we see it when he comes back after he's been injured. He's now been disillusioned. He sees the world in a different way. He views himself in a different way. It's now grainy. It's gritty. The cinematography is completely different. The colors are now drained. It's really lacking the vividness of the shots we saw in the 50s. And it's a completely different place. And of course, it was a completely different place. It's 14 years after that opening sequence. And the town, as we've heard, has lost a lot of men, and it has lost a lot of its own sense of identity because of the war. But from the moment he gets out and he looks around, we see through his eyes, through Stone's camera, a completely different world, I think largely because he's a completely different person.
Absolutely. And there's a certain detail here, too, where this completely contradicts the first parade sequence, because this is Ron's chance. This is almost utterly dispiriting for him, because this is his one chance to become the victor yet.
Right.
And if that is a quality of manhood still in his mind, to be the victor, well, he could be the victor at this parade. He's the war hero. And they treat him as such. Other veterans drive him around. But what happens?
Yeah.
He doesn't get saluted as such. He gets bum-rushed by some protesting hippies, mm-hmm. right? And that is almost – there are a couple of turning points, I think, is what you're watching here, turning points in his awareness, his disillusionment, and this is – a very early one, realizing that I'm not even going to be recognized as a winner. And of course, there's the parallel of what does that mean for the nation?
Right.
That this is the war where America's not seen as the winner. And now he is supposed to be coming home, claiming the spoils, claiming the attention of women. And instead, he doesn't get that. He gets protested.
Exactly. And those faces when he gets out of the car and everyone comes up to him to meet him, I don't know how Stone captured it, because the acting of all of those extras or all those people in that scene who we don't really meet otherwise in the film, but they're just people from the neighborhood. When they look at him, it's a look you give to someone who you feel like they're almost a burden on you. They're putting you in an uncomfortable position, and it's now awkward, but it's their fault, and you're trying to do the right thing. And it's so devastating. And you're right, that ties in perfectly to the parade sequence that follows not too long after, because here's the thing about it. When they're standing on that stage, Ed Lauder, the actor, is giving the speech, and he's talking about how we're going to win Vietnam, and he's still trying to get the crowd pumped up and trying to sort of relive their former glory as a town, as a country. People cheer, and they hail as heroes all the names of the people who have died, right? But the guy who's left, but the guy who isn't a quote-unquote man anymore, who's lost his legs, who makes them feel bad.
To look at.
Yeah, who they have to look at and be reminded of their collective failure. They don't really know what to do with him. And in that moment, the Kovic character doesn't express it. Stone doesn't do anything more assertive with the camera or in any kind of filmmaking way. But it really suggests to me that he does realize, Kovic realizes, that he would have been better off dying. That would have been the only way to be a victor, is somehow at least he would have had that respect of one of these people who died. And that's a brutal realization.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about Raymond J. Barry as Kovic's father, because that was a really moving performance for me and handled very differently than I think Stone and the actress Carolyn Cava, who plays Ron's mother. I know there are different relationships and there's tension, but that one is a little too big for me. But consider that sequence you talked about when he does first come home and how his father, who's a quieter man, is in the background for much of it. And then he wheels Ron into the house and just starts showing him all the things he's adapted the house so things will be easier for Ron.
You need some help?
No, I'm okay, Dad.
Fixed up a bathroom for you, Ronnie. I'm hungry. Put a wider doorway in.
We're having spaghetti.
I built a shower for you, too. You can get in here pretty easy. Oh, and I put some handles on the toilet for you. Ronnie.
Thanks, Dad.
There's something similar going on, but much more subdued, to that stage sequence you just talked about where his father just stops, gives up, and knows that he's been putting on a charade, just crumples over and gives him a silent hug.
Yeah.
That was like just
it's devastating.
It
crushed me.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then there's another follow-up to that. This is later on after Ron has come home from one of his drunken nights out. He actually gets into one of those screaming matches with his mother, and we see his father reattaching the catheter.
Yeah, that's the who's going to love me sequence.
Yeah, that's where he says that phrase. But before he even says that, there's just Stone films it in discreet silhouette and just that gesture, which really, you know, I think his father is an interesting character because he is a veteran as well. But in many ways, he goes against this idealized mid-century version of masculinity.
He does.
Everyone knows he doesn't run the house.
No.
That's clear.
It almost seems like he inherited the glory of that past, but his son has to somehow earn it.
Yeah, you know? That makes sense. And I like how he becomes this vision of a servant in that scene to Ron in such a quietly powerful way.
It's good to have you. It's good to have you, Ronnie.
I agree with you completely on that scene. And there are a couple other moments that I wanted to single out. When he meets with Kira Sedgwick, now that Donna has gone off to college, and they're just at a little dive restaurant or something, having a drink, listening to Edie Brickell sing A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. And she's saying a lot of counterculture talk and anti-war talk, and he's really just kind of taking it all in. And when he finally says something, do you remember what he says?
Remember the prom? Moon River, wider than the sea, my huckleberry friend, remember that?
Yeah.
Moon River for me.
Even he in that moment is still stuck in this mythology of pre-Vietnam America, right? Prom night. Like his crowning moment almost was probably that rain-drenched stroll into the gym and grabbing her and kissing her there. And that's all he can do. He has no other perspective on life at all or real perspective of the world other than what he's suffered through at this point and then what he remembers from the past, from his glory days. And so that really stood out for me. And then how about the shot? I don't think I'm crazy here. Having watched some De Palma recently for the show, we get a De Palma diopter shot in the sequence where he goes to apologize to Wilson's family for killing him. And Lily Taylor plays Wilson's wife.
Mm-hmm.
And she's sitting on the couch with their young son, who apparently she was pregnant with when he went off to war. And the way Stone frames the shot, he uses that diopter to minimize the distance between them. She's on the couch behind him, kind of over his shoulder, and it's almost like he's looking at her because he's turned a little bit, and it just almost puts them on top of each other. And it's really effective in the way De Palma can use it to be really effective as well. So you get some of those filmmaking flourishes that you would expect from Stone, and they work here.
Well, it's just the intensity of that moment for him, because that is another turning point in terms of what does it mean for him now to be a man? Because the movie stripped all of this away from him at this point. And I wondered, you know, is Stone or is Born on the 4th of July going to offer an alternative vision of manhood, or is this simply going to be a stripping away? And I don't know if it entirely does, because some of the things that he reclaims are also related to violence and victory when he becomes a protester as well. A lot
for
of those protests get very physical and they're geared to win, right? But I did, you know, in that confession scene, it's very interesting how it's the first time you see things like humility and you see an openness, really, which are not associated with manhood generally. No. And that is why I think that moment is so crucial, and using the camera in that way to really push us in on his face and the intensity, because he's not only confessing what happened in the war, but he's turning over his whole conception of what it might mean moving forward to be a man.
Yeah. And I don't know that there's an alternative to offer, or that Stone has one to offer, because I think he would tell you it's so elemental to who we are, perhaps as Americans, but just as human beings. And actually that ties in with something that really provoked me when I was looking at Matt Zollersite's book, The Oliver Stone Experience, which I read after I had seen Born on the Fourth again and I'd gotten all ready for the show. And one of the things I didn't put down in my notes because it didn't really resonate with me was a moment that seemed like a clear homage to 2001. It's in the Massapequa sequence early on. The parade, you have a girl, like a high school age girl, with a baton, and she throws the baton up in the air. And I think, or I have to think, just about any cinephile out there who has seen 2001 once or seen that image on YouTube knows that that feels and looks an awful lot like the Dawn of Man, the end of the Dawn of Man sequence, when that bone fragment, the weapon, goes up into the air. But I dismissed it because I thought, well, first of all, Stone doesn't follow through on a match cut in the same way that Kubrick does. And then I just thought, well, what's the connection to what is happening in the Dawn of Man sequence in this really violent moment and what's happening in this parade? And then Matt just had one little line in a question to Stone in that book where he brings up 2001. And then it finally did click for me based on what Matt said, where we're not those barbaric apes anymore who had to flaunt our violent instincts, right? We're now civilized. So what we do instead is we still have those violent instincts, but we cloak them in pageantry. Mm-hmm. We cloak them in pageantry, but that entire sequence, that entire parade, in some ways is really just a celebration of our warlike spirit and our violent tendencies. And so there is a connection there. There is something just ingrained in us, I think Stone would suggest anyway.
And our victories. And that's why in the second parade, Ron doesn't belong.
Yeah, you're right. The music. Can't end this without at least mentioning, I have to anyway, the John Williams score. All these contradictions and all this dissonance and subversions that we're talking about here all come through, I think, in those main themes where you've got that trumpet. That instantly suggests to me patriotism. There's a certain jingoism to it. It's militaristic to hear that trumpet, like the bugle, resonating the way it does. But it's so melancholy. And the music that's underneath it is so kind of dark that it becomes really haunting, like this entire film.
Before we wrap up, let me ask you about this movie's end. Did it feel a little abrupt to you when we're at the... Okay.
No, I'm glad you brought this up because I love this movie. I loved it when I was 17 or 18. I love it now. The only issue I had with it ultimately, and I could nitpick where early in the movie, Stone is not at all subtle about the moment where his mother turns to him when they're watching President Kennedy give his inaugural address. And she says, Ronnie, I had a dream that you were standing in front of a large crowd and you were saying really important words, powerful words. Knowing the film, I knew that that was obviously foreshadowing what's going to happen at the end of the movie at the Democratic National Convention. That is how this movie concludes.
Does it cut back to it as well when he's in front of the parade crowd?
It might.
Or is that
it
my...
It might.
There it would be ironically.
But at some point in there, Stone can't leave it alone. He actually has to replay the mother's line just in case we missed it.
There's a little bludgeoning
earlier on.
Going on
but
here.
But there is something... I think Sam in his Letterboxd review of this movie used the word episodic, and that's something I didn't remember, just how episodic it was. And it doesn't really feel like a problem at all until the end of this movie where he undergoes this huge transformation from the character we see in Mexico to a radical protester to a speaker ultimately at the DNC, this kind of shining moment. It all happens so fast, and it all happens in some ways off screen. I mean, you could argue that the whole movie's been leading up to this transformation, but you don't get to experience it. And all of a sudden, he is an author who's written a book. And as Chuck Klosterman said on our 600th episode, people sitting at typewriters or computers isn't really compelling drama. So maybe that's partly why it got left out. But Stone does all these amazing things, and there's such a great craft and storytelling and attention to detail in the first 2 hours of this movie. And then it feels like at the end, they felt like they had to tack it on. And actually, I did just read today. I think in the book, it suggests something like they did add on the triumphant moment in 76 at the DNC. Like, that was something they did actually tack onto the film. So it feels that way probably for a good reason.
Well, and maybe the triumphant nature of it is part of what rubs me the wrong way too, because we're almost coming full circle.
Right.
Like, this was a movie that was repudiating this idea of you must triumph in so many ways, but yet it perhaps necessarily, as a big Hollywood movie, is going to have to end that way somehow. And the way they managed to do that just didn't quite work. I also think there's something of the personal loss there. Even though this is clearly happening to him and it's his moment of triumph, I felt removed. It was almost like the scale of it that was happening at this political convention. We had somewhat – Platoon is sort of like Stone's national take on the Vietnam War. And Born on the 4th of July is very much his personal take, I feel, because we're so rooted, we're so tied to this one
character. Even the character in Platoon is more tied to him personally.
It is. And, and there you do essentially follow the Charlie Sheen character's story. But still, he's a guide more for us, I feel like, whereas here this is all about the transformation of this man. And yeah, when we broaden out to encompass the convention at the end, he's more of a figure within history than a figure who's really defining history because of who he is.
No, you're right. Even in the way the shouting matches are portrayed and shot when he's at the Republican convention, he feels, even though he's supposedly in a position of power, or at least personally, he feels like he's doing something important and powerful and righteous. He feels more like a pawn in those sequences. Yeah. He's sort of lost in the scope of that.
Though a great Stone technique during those Republican protest scenes where all of a sudden we're watching him through a news camera, so it's that grainy video footage, and we just segue out into the 35 millimeter. I like when Stone does that.
Yeah. Born on the 4th of July is available to rent or stream through most platforms. You may also find it on your 300-level film class, Images of War in the Age of Apocalypse, Coppola, Kubrick, and Stone. If that doesn't exist, anybody out there, you're welcome to it. If you've seen Born on the 4th of July recently and agree or disagree with our takes, email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
One thing I learned from Matt Zollersites' book, Adam.
Yeah?
Oliver Stone once wanted to be an actor.
Well, didn't we all?
Well, we're going to show him how it's done next with Massacre Theater. Stay with us.
In the depths of dizziness, I picked a fight with myself like a real roughneck. Screaming, you don't know who you're dealing with. I threw a hell of a punch, but I couldn't connect. At the edge of a silhouette, I caught a glimpse of a face I will never forget. Speaking future words of an idiot, I understood them at once but didn't know what I meant. Be still or break everything. Drawing of a bag. Kill what you want, or save everything you can. Be still, you're the picture of a man.
All right, can you picture it? The picture of a man.
Sir, I have a proposition. We're decent people being driven from our homes. Slaughtered in cold blood.
So you seek revenge?
I seek righteousness. But I'll take revenge.
Fear not, young lady, Denzel will not let you down. Bit of the trailer there for the Magnificent Seven remake, which opens this weekend. We're going to have a review of that one next week, and we're also going to do our top five Denzel Washington performances.
We are hoping to pull off another fun guest for that one. We are, of course, a little bit gun-shy about promising things because they can fall through. I hinted a few weeks ago very vaguely that we might have a special guest for this Oliver Stone show. It did seem like for a while we were not only going to have Matt Zollersites on, but have Oliver Stone on. And see, that fell through.
It fell through.
So I'm glad we didn't promise it.
Maybe if you had promised it,
yeah,
it would have put the pressure on.
Wish fulfillment. But we have someone we're 99% locked in with, so that will be fun. Someone who definitely is an authority on all things Denzel Washington. Our current film spotting poll question is also Denzel related. We have two of them, actually, slightly different wording. Best Denzel performance, favorite Denzel performance. The results so far indicate that words, Josh, who knew, matter.
More people are voting in one than the other? Is that what we're learning?
Or? No, we're getting different results.
We're getting
so
different
far.
Results. Okay.
We are. And we will share those results in full next week on the show on our Denzel Spectacular, when we will also review his latest, The Magnificent Seven. We'll also get to the first film in our next marathon, a 6-week look at the films of Luis Buñuel. The lineup and more is available at filmspotting.net. First up, a pair of Buñuel short films, L'Âge d'Or and Un Chien Andalou. Andalou from 1929 is available via DVD, also pretty widely available online via YouTube, and L'Âge d'Or is from 1930. That's available online and also to rent via Netflix and Amazon. This Buñuel Marathon is presented by our friends at Mubi. And this week, Josh, in addition to one of the early films in our marathon, Robinson Crusoe, Buñuel's version of that story, that is available right now. So for the next 30 days, you can see it on the Mubi platform. But they have other films as well, some that you may be familiar with, like this first title we're going to mention, and some like the second one that maybe most listeners like us aren't too familiar with.
You've never heard of Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill, huh?
That was the one I have heard of.
Oh, you have. Okay. So you haven't wondered anymore why a flock of wild parrots found their way to San Francisco's North Beach?
No.
You know the answer now. Well, if someone does want to find out, you can with this documentary from Judy Irving. It takes a compassionate look at this urban phenomenon. The other title Mubi has that we wanted to highlight is Kravina. It comes from the Sarajevo-born, Toronto-based Igor Drzlaka, a major talent to watch, having devoted his first two features to the emotional, dramatic, and existential complexity of the lives of Yugoslavian expats.
Sounds fascinating, and yet another film Mubi is offering that I am curious to see. Every day, Mubi's curators introduce a new title, and you have 30 days to watch it. So there's always 30 wonderful films to enjoy, all for only $4.99 a month. And you can use their mobile app to download films to watch offline. Our listeners can try Mubi free for a month. You just have to go to Mubi.com/filmspotting, Mubi.com/filmspotting. A couple other notes we wanted to mention. We have more tickets to give away. This one's about a month off, but a movie we're really excited about, the latest from Kelly Reichert, Certain Women.
Can't wait.
Opening in Chicago, and we have tickets to see that in advance in mid-October, and also Operation Avalanche, your last chance to see that here in Chicago if you are so inclined. Just go to filmspotting.net and you will find the links in the top stories section. We also have details there about the live show we've been promoting. This live show that's actually going to happen, not like the planned 600th live show, but we're going to have fun with Matt and Allison from Film Spotting SVU, along with the fine folks from The Next Picture Show, November 17th through the 19th at three different Chicago venues. It is the Chicago Podcast Festival, and we're going to do a double bill with SVU and then us on the 18th at Shuba's. Tickets are on sale now. You can learn more at chicagopodcastfestival.org.
Do we know what we're talking about yet?
Nope.
Is that that's usually the time of year we do our Golden Brick
right.
show. Maybe that could be part of it.
I threw that out and our intrepid producer Sam shot it down.
Oh, okay.
So
never mind.
So
then.
That's off.
On to another idea.
On to another idea, indeed. In fact, let's get on to Massacre Theater.
It's the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance at winning a prize. A couple weeks back, Adam and I massacred this scene.
What, are you prospecting? Jesus Christ. You are a dangerous man. You're going to risk our lives for a Twinkie?
There's a box of Twinkies in that grocery store. Not just any box of Twinkies. The last box of Twinkies that anyone will enjoy in the whole universe. Believe it or not, Twinkies have an expiration date. Someday very soon, life's little Twinkie gauge is gonna go empty. Time to nut up or shut up.
Woody Harrelson as Tallahassee there with Jesse Eisenberg's Columbus in 2009 Zombieland. It was written by Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, directed by Ruben Fleischer.
That Massacre was part of a show where we shared our top five comedies of the 21st century. We also did a Sacred Cow review of Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein on that episode, our ode to the late great Gene Wilder. And if connections to Zombieland still aren't clear, here's Gordon Danford writing in from Sue Japan. Do you think I'm saying that right? TSU?
That was perfect. Mm. Adam provides the strongest connection with his number two pick for top comedy of the 2000s, Shaun of the Dead. Zombies? Zombies.
There you go. Peter Hengeler says, besides the connection to the top five comedies of the 21st century, there is the obvious connection to Young Frankenstein, as both are fun films with reanimated corpses and curly-headed, nervous Nelly leading men. So that was something we didn't think about. Gene Wilder and Jesse Eisenberg.
I guess that does make sense. Lisa N. from Waltham, Massachusetts said, as usual, Adam has been typecast as the more neurotic of the two characters. How about having Adam play the tough guy next time while Josh plays the nervous fella?
Yeah, how about that?
Okay.
Why don't we do that sometime?
Have you been working on your tough guy?
Well, no, but I should have done that. I mean, Eisenberg just came off playing Woody Allen. Essentially,
yes.
In the very
That's
disappointing
true.
Woody Allen film Cafe Society, and he really is channeling Woody there. So I could have gone down that path, and in fact, that would have made some sense. Michael Roche, Leonia, New Jersey, sends us this. Woody Harrelson doesn't have to worry about losing a role to Josh, because that was shockingly not the most brilliant performance of the Tallahassee role in Zombieland.
I apologize,
okay.
Michael.
Aside from being perhaps one of the funniest scenes of the century so far, I also made the connection that both Zombieland's Jesse Eisenberg and Emma Stone shared the distinction with Gene Wilder of having starred in films by a different Woody Allen.
See, that is high-level connection work going on.
It is. And it turns out Tanya McAvoy in Denver, Colorado also noted, Josh, that Woody Harrelson, of course, is in Natural Born Killers, the Oliver Stone movie, and we had teased this very episode devoted to Oliver Stone back on that show. So connections, they do abound. Josh, why don't you reach into the film spotting hat, the overflowing film spotting hat. Yes, we knew it was easy. Turns out it was. Reach in, pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Catherine Oakes. She's from Yardville, New Jersey.
Congratulations, Catherine. Email feedback@filmspotting.net to get your very own film spotting t-shirt.
No, Miss Lamont, round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
We move on to this week's scene, and maybe taking a cue from some of our listeners, I'm going to get to go against type a little bit. I'm not going to play the woman in this scene. I'm going to play, I guess, kind of a tough guy, at least.
Lisa's going to get her.
This
dish.
Actor has been a tough guy in some movies, but it turns out, Josh, that while that's very gallant of you to give me the tough guy role, in fact, you gobbled up the juicier role.
I need to take a deep breath before we get into this one.
Once again, I'm playing the straight man. I'm ready when you are. You started off. Are you breathy enough?
Wait.
And action.
Everything, every single thing we've said or done since we've been in that house, nothing has been between us. Can we just get in our own car and drive back to Boston tonight? Just leave everything.
They'll find us.
How do you go to work tomorrow? How do you look at him? How do you say to him?
I talk about work.
That's insane.
I thought of every possible way. Here, in the Caymans, in Washington, that's all I've done. Try to think of a way out. If we run, they find us, and Ray gets killed.
But if you testify...
The FBI says they'll help Ray and protect us.
Protect what? What are you? What are you going to do?
Go in tomorrow and start to copy files. I don't have a choice. And
scene. I'm done.
Wow.
I have nothing left for the rest of the show.
Okay, I'll take this part. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, October 2nd. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks to get official Massacre Theater rules. Visit filmspotting.net.
Where's the modern battlefield, soldier?
Everywhere.
What's the first rule of battle?
Never reveal your position.
And if one unauthorized person knew, if Congress knew,
and so would the enemy.
That, Mr. Snowden, is the state of the world. Secrecy is security, and security is victory.
It only seemed fitting as we get to Matt Zollersite's top five Oliver Stone scenes in a minute and reflect back on a movie like Born on the 4th of July that lives up to its sacred cow billing, we get to his latest film. So let's talk about Snowden for a few minutes, Josh. In many ways, it's very hard to not see it as a companion to Born on the 4th of July, though you could make a similar statement as the one I'm about to make in connection with many Oliver Stone films and certain heroes of his, where this Snowden character, very much like Ron Kovic, is someone who grew up with a pretty conservative view of America and some heavy ideals in place and becomes disillusioned, and is someone who you could see as a patriot who becomes so disillusioned that you could make the argument both of these men become betrayers of America and America's principles. I know how you felt about Born on the 4th of July. How did you feel about Snowden?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, you could say the same of Jim Garrison and JFK, right? These are establishment insiders at the start, and they come to believe that the system they're a part of is rotten, and they go on to try to correct or fix that at great personal cost.
Yeah.
So it definitely falls into that trajectory. It was interesting to see it in that light, having spent time revisiting some of Stone's work. I don't think I would put it up anywhere near Born on the 4th of July, mm-hmm. but I did enjoy it. I think it has some biopic faults that we'll probably get into at the end. It was also an interesting way to look at Stone's aesthetic. Speaking of JFK, if that and maybe Natural Born Killers are where he is at his most heightened in terms of using editing and camera angles and different film stock, this pulls way back on that while also telling a similar story, essentially being a piece of anti-propaganda propaganda in a much quieter way. So there were these little aesthetic flecks throughout that I did appreciate. One example would be in the early romance scenes between Snowden, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and his girlfriend, Lindsay Mills, played by Shailene Woodley. They're on a date, and she's taking his picture, and Stone would cut away to the black and white images that would result. I also like how Gordon-Levitt Snowden is blocking the camera, like before he's even discovered what surveillance is going on.
He's already pretty suspicious, private, right? Yeah.
But notice they walk past the White House, and Stone segues very elegantly to still photos of the anti-Bush protesters who are there, because this is during the Iraq War. And the way he mixes in her shots with shots of the protesters was a quieter version of what he does a lot in JFK.
And
I really like those elements, which there aren't a ton in Snowden. It's a pretty straightforward film overall, but there were enough for me to keep it interesting.
Well, we know that they are just walking through when a protest might be going on. But to someone who is looking at those photos later, they may assume that they're part of the protest, right? And actually makes me think of the sequence in Born on the 4th of July where he is visiting Kira Sedgwick at Syracuse and he goes to a protest. And then when the police start tear gassing and beating people up, he gets caught
in that.
He's
caught up in the melee.
They just assume that he is one of them. Another character that fits into this Stone philosophy here a little bit or into this scheme would be, of course, the character Charlie Sheen plays to an extent in Wall Street, not based on a real man, not a super patriot, someone not really into personal sacrifice, but he does have a sense of how the world works that when he encounters someone who is sort of like the devil, you know, he does have a loss of innocence, just like all of these characters have at some point a loss of innocence. But with Snowden, I was enjoying this movie in the same way I enjoy a lot of Oliver Stone movies for a good half to two-thirds of it. And Gordon-Levitt's take on Snowden is a substantial part of it. He certainly gets the voice right with Snowden.
He really alters his voice.
If you have seen the Laura Poitras documentary, Citizen Four, or if you've seen any interviews with Snowden, I remember seeing him not too long ago on Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, he gets it right.
Our government is hemorrhaging billions of dollars every year to Chinese hackers. And I've been hired to shut them down. A lot of people are depending on me.
More so than anyone else?
Yes.
He conveys how analytic and rational and serious and calm he is. And that really, for me, what was so interesting about Citizen Four, how damn reasonable Snowden comes off. I didn't know much about him, didn't pay a ton of attention to the news story, certainly didn't get into all the nuances and details of what exactly he did, what information he leaked, why he did it. And then you watch a movie like that, and whether or not you come away thinking what he did was the right thing, you at least understand where he's coming from, and you recognize that he didn't just leak a bunch of documents out to the world. He gave them to journalists, and he is someone who's willing to be punished for what he did. He just doesn't want to be punished under the Espionage Act, as it's been basically bastardized in recent years to be a lot more draconian than it originally was or probably needs to be. So again, not saying you have to believe he's a hero. I still don't know how I feel about Snowden and what he did, but I recognize that it's a really complex situation, full of nuance, and he's a complex man who recognizes all that nuance. So keeping that all in mind, where the movie then goes off the rails for me is that Stone, being Stone, I guess, just can't stop himself from, I suppose the word is, propagandizing, right? He has to lionize Snowden. And I think that's a problem when it's completely incongruous with Snowden's personality and his actions, as I know them to be and as they are depicted earlier in this film. He's a man who felt a moral imperative to do this. He did it because he thought it was something he had to do. He did it dispassionately, mostly. He says this at one point. He did it, and then he basically wants to let the world draw the conclusions they're going to draw. He wants them to just reckon with the material. He obviously made a subjective choice here based on his own values, but he did it in as objective a way possible. And again, let everyone else draw conclusions. Stone can't let us draw any conclusion but the one he wants us to draw by the end of this movie, and he hammers us with that message for the last 20 minutes or so.
For the last 20 minutes, that's probably where it starts. For me, it's that final sequence where the movie is handed over to the actual Snowden.
I know.
And it's an interesting aesthetic turn in that there's an image of Gordon Levitt as Snowden on a screen. He's basically teleconferencing in to a conference while he's in exile, and it's Gordon Levitt answering questions. We cut away, we cut back, and it's Snowden. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking that has to be filmed for this movie. So Snowden, to a degree, is acting here,
yes.
Right? Which is an interesting to try to compartmentalize that with what's going on. But it does lead into one of these finales, which I'm afraid it's that time of year. We're going to get it where a movie literally applauds itself.
Right.
And the audience at the conference stands up. They're applauding Snowden. And yes, you're right. It does turn into propaganda, but it also turns into this self-serving, hooray for us and our movie. And it just happens too often when award season comes around. And so it was unfortunate to see it happen in a movie I'd otherwise pretty much enjoyed.
Yeah. I think really it all begins at the point of the narrative where he makes the decision to go to Hawaii, which is where he ultimately did steal the data from. His motivations for taking the job are multitude at this point, and they're mostly unclear. It almost comes off, and I don't think this is the implication, but it almost comes off like he might have even taken the job just so he'd have access to the material, because it otherwise doesn't make any sense why at the point in his life when he's the happiest that he would go back in, and there's some new things introduced about his health, and it just becomes really, really muddy at this point. And then, yes, we get to the moment, as you said, by the end when we're applauding him, we're applauding this movie happening essentially. And I just don't like how compacted everything was, where kind of like Born on the 4th of July, where I lamented the first 2 hours are so good and those last 23 minutes or whatever, I felt like we had
speed
just
up.
A lot of storytelling had to happen. Well, at the end of this film, it becomes almost like a documentary all of a sudden, where it's just a bunch of newscasts and headlines, and it covers months and months in a few minutes, in a completely unsatisfying
way. Sort of the fallout once the documents have been leaked.
Yeah. I wish that Stone actually had made the decision at that point, but then maybe he wouldn't have had the validation moment that he wanted at the end of this film, a more celebratory moment. But I wish he had followed Poitras's lead a little bit with Citizen Four, where she just focuses on what she filmed, right? She filmed him in that room in Hong Kong going through the process of releasing that information out into the world. She didn't try to tell the entire Ed Snowden story. And Stone does, or kind of does.
Yeah, we should say that her interviews of him are sort of the framing device with Melissa Leo as Poitras. I liked how that allowed us to feel the tension of those moments of actually publishing this material and the pressure that they were under, and then ducking away to see parts of his life earlier before this began.
Yeah, I agree. Those sequences are mostly effective, though I do wonder what Glenn Greenwald does think of Zachary Quinto's performance, only because I feel like he comes off more aggressively than Greenwald comes off playing himself in Citizen Four. But I'm just curious.
Yeah, I liked the sort of on a deadline, you know, he's got the story in his teeth and doesn't want to lose it.
He's not going to wait for the bureaucracy.
I think that came through.
Yeah, it definitely comes through. Snowden is out now, still in wide release. If you've seen it, tell us what we got right, what we got wrong, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Well, we could have probably pulled off our own lists of the top five Oliver Stone scenes, but why do that when we could hear the picks of an expert like Matt Zoller-Seitz, author of The Oliver Stone Experience? Matt joins us next. Stay with us. A little girl sinks down in the deep end and looks up towards the sky into a little blue world of legs and her feet. They look like they're in flight in a slow motion dance while the water expands, the sun's refracted light. Has to pretend she can hear the music. When she starts crying in her goggles, the scene becomes unclear, but she keeps peering into this underworld through the filter of her tears, which let her keep hold of the moment as if it was a souvenir. She just has to pretend she knows how to use it.
Generations of Americans have been taught that the United States reluctantly dropped atomic bombs at the end of World War II to save the lives of hundreds of thousands of young men poised to die in an invasion of Japan. But the story is really more complicated, more interesting, and much more disturbing. Many Americans view...
No, that isn't the plot of an unmade Oliver Stone film, but Stone himself narrating his 10-part documentary series from 2012, The Untold History of the United States. We're going to go from the voice of Oliver Stone to the man who just might be the definitive critical voice on Oliver Stone. We're lucky to be joined from Brooklyn by film and TV critic Matt Zoller-Seitz. Matt's new book about Stone, The Oliver Stone Experience, just hit bookstores last week. Matt's the editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com and the author of The Wes Anderson Collection and Mad Men, The Complete Critical Companion, among others. He is a busy, busy man. Matt, thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time.
Thank you.
Matt, it's getting ridiculous. I almost need a separate coffee table at this point for just your books because they're piling up and they're also quite big, beautiful books that you put out.
Well, you know, one person who interviewed me joked that the Oliver Stone book is a coffee table.
That's true. It could hold.
You could just like put the other books on top of that one.
I like that idea. I'll do that.
Me too. There you go. Well, we played that clip. We thought it'd make a nice transition, partly because you suggested it was one of the scenes that you were kind of considering as we're going to get into your top five Oliver Stone scenes here in a moment. But you thought it was important for listeners, if they haven't already, to hear Oliver Stone's voice. Why is that?
Well, because I've been living with it off and on for, 6 years now. The first time I interviewed Oliver in person was 2010 when he was touring to publicize Wall Street Money Never Sleeps, and I interviewed him at the Bloomberg News Building in Manhattan, and it was supposed to last 20 minutes and ended up running for more than an hour because he enjoyed talking to me. And I invited him to screen Nixon and the third cut of Alexander at the Museum of the Moving Image the following spring, and he came to that. And actually, a transcript of our discussion of Alexander it forms probably 50% of the chapter on that film. And then I interviewed him again when he got an honorary degree from NYU, like honorary doctorate, which is where he went to film school and studied under Martin Scorsese. And then a few months after that, Savages came out, and I interviewed him again, and I realized, like, I've already got four really pretty meaty interviews with this guy. I was looking for another subject. I had just finished the Wes Anderson book. I just turned it into the publisher, and I thought, well, maybe Oliver Stone could be my next book. And, you know, there were a couple more books in between those, The Grand Budapest Hotel standalone book and Mad Men Carousel. But this was a very complicated book. It was a very, very complicated book to put together. And but the unifying thread is Oliver Stone's voice, like his authorial voice, his filmmaking voice, but also just his voice. He's a really great storyteller and mesmerizing. And I have over 100 hours of recorded audio with him talking about all kinds of things. And some of them are directly related to his life and his work. And there are other long sections which I couldn't put in the book because I didn't want it to be like 4,000 pages long, where he's just, you know, arguing with me about current and past films and you know, giving me life advice. Like, there are periods where every interview would have a kind of ritual to it, which is I would arrive at his office or his house or his apartment, and he would immediately start quizzing me on the events of the day. What do you think of this? What do you think of this treaty? What do you think of this country invading this other country? What do you think about the presidential race, or so forth? And then we would talk about movies we had seen recently. And I've interviewed a lot of directors in the 25 plus years that I've been doing this. And one thing that always struck me was a lot of directors don't actually watch contemporary films, mm-hmm. except like they kind of binge them at the end of the year because they have to vote on them for the Oscars. But Oliver actually goes to the movies. He goes to the movies regularly, and he keeps up with stuff that, you know, just came out in the last couple of weeks. And a lot of times he would recommend things to me that I hadn't seen, and, you know, we'd argue about things we'd both seen. But I wanted to put his voice up at the top there just so people could get a sense of the voice that I hear talking in my own mind, mm-hmm. now that I've spent so much time with the guy.
Well, none of those encounters that you listed or this book are by accident. I know the answer to this question a little bit, having read some of the book and also having heard your interview a few years back on the Cinephiliacs, where it was kind of based around or centered on Born on the 4th of July. But why Stone in the first place? Maybe for the people out there who don't know, who haven't heard that or read as much, why is Oliver Stone such an important filmmaker to you?
You know, I started becoming a kind of a more serious film goer in the 80s when I was in high school. And he was the first one who was of that era, who was an American filmmaker, who was making mainstream films that were artistically and politically interesting and that seemed extremely personal no matter what subject he was tackling. There were other directors that I was interested in who had preceded him, people like Scorsese, his former film school teacher, and Francis Coppola and Robert Altman and a lot of these other people who are now recognized as some of the giants of what we call the American New Wave. But Stone and Spike Lee both kind of burst onto the scene in 1986. Spike Lee with She's Gotta Have It and Oliver Stone with Salvador and Platoon in the same year, which is quite a double feature. And I was a little bit sort of depressed, honestly, by a lot of the American movies that I was seeing in multiplexes. And I grew up in Dallas. And, you know, I know that there's a sort of, among people a generation behind me, there's a kind of a retro fetishistic appreciation of 80s cinema, which I totally get because, you know, when I was in high school, we were into 60s midnight movies and cult films and 70s blaxploitation and kung fu and stuff like that. So like there's, you know, and I'm sure that the generation before me had their own version of that. But at the time, like a budding cinephile, like having movies like Flashdance and Footloose and Cobra and Top Gun and, you know, Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Like, these are all right in my wheelhouse, Matt, so.
You know, I know they are, but dude, I mean, really, yeah. Like that's, we're not talking, I mean, they're not Blue Velvet, they're not something wild, they're not Manhunter.
No.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and, but Stone was a different animal. Like he really had some classical old school virtues, and also he got increasingly aggressive and experimental with his style, and I really, really liked it. And then there was also this weird Dallas connection, which is Stone wanted to make Born on the 4th of July in 1988 with Tom Cruise. He tried to make it 10 years earlier with Al Pacino, and it fell apart. And he was going to shoot it in Dallas with Oak Cliff, which is a neighborhood of Dallas, doubling as Massapequa, because, you know, a lot of the architecture from the 30s, 40s, and 50s was untouched at the time. And then Tom Cruise went off to do something else. I can't remember what it was, but I think it might have been Rain Man. And he was cooling his heels, and he said, "We're all, you know, my entire production company is relocated to Dallas. What are we going to do?" So he made talk radio. He made a film version of talk radio. He shot it at Las Colinas, which is a studio facility not too far from the Dallas-Fort Worth airport. And I saw that in a theater, and I didn't realize that that movie was shot in Dallas and actually set there. And then he made Born on the 4th of July, which is a big Dallas production, and I was an extra in that. I was in the riot sequence at Syracuse University, and I got beaten on the head by an extra playing a National Guardsman.
Gee.
So,
are you visible at all in the final film?
No, then? I'm not. I've gone through that thing like it's the Zapruder.
Uh-huh.
I've like freeze-framed every frame of that sequence, hoping to catch a glimpse of myself. But I ended up on the cutting room floor. And actually, I've actually been an extra in two Oliver Stone films, and I've been cut twice. And the other one was Snowden. I was on the set of Snowden. And
was this after he got an early look at the book?
Yeah, no, I don't know. No, it wasn't. It was just a pacing thing. Like, you know, it was the beginning of a shot. Like, Snowden was walking to meet somebody, and I was in the background. And obviously, when he cut the film together, he decided, let's just start the scene with the two people already talking. You know, like one of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And then he shot JFK, which is, you know, super-duper-duper Dallas. I mean, that's the most Dallas thing you can possibly film in Dallas, as a recreation of the murder of John F. Kennedy. And so there was a Dallas connection there. So in a weird way, I sort of, in retrospect, I feel like I was fated to do this book, you know? Like, it's strange that the two major American filmmakers that I've done exhaustive books on, Wes Anderson and Oliver Stone, both have these really strong Dallas connections.
So this relates somewhat, Matt, to the idea of Stone's voice and getting the chance to hear him as you read the book. You use exclamation points, I noticed, a lot in the Q&A portions. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that, whether that is meant to capture. As I read it, I got this impression of a guy who was really enthusiastic and emphatic about everything. And the way you described your sessions captures that a little bit too, where he'd come right at you at the beginning and want to know what you think about the day's events. Was that something strategic as well, to use all those exclamation points to kind of give us a taste of his enthusiasm for life?
Yeah, and I actually have to give credit for that to this guy named Jeremy Fassler, who's been my transcriber for almost everything that I've done in book form, and also for some really long form reported features that I've done for New York Magazine, like the Michelle McLaren story, where I spent 2 days hanging out with her. I would just dump my stuff to Jeremy. And Jeremy, I noticed when he was giving me the transcripts back that there were a lot of exclamation points. And I thought, like, well, I'm just going to leave most of those in, because mm-hmm. that accurately captures what it's like to talk to Oliver Stone. Like, if you look at the Wes Anderson experience, there aren't a lot of exclamation points in
right.
that. He's a much more chill guy, whereas Stone, like his movies, is much more active. He's just much more active. And also, like, the volume level tended to be higher. Like, when we're talking to each other, we're sort of borderline shouting. Sometimes we're actually shouting. And I've noticed that he gets that excited with everybody. When I went to visit the set of Snowden, I spent 2 days there, and at the end of the first day, he said, "Hey, I'm going out to dinner with some friends of mine. Do you want to come with me?" And I said, "Of course." And I thought it was going to be people from the production, but it turned out to be a bunch of historians. He had invited all of these historians that he had relationships with to come out to the set and be extras. And, you know, I'm sure that it was partly related to him being friends with them, and it was partly because he wanted more extras.
Sure.
And Peter Kuznick, who co-wrote Untold History, later told me, when he found out that I'd been briefly an extra in a scene of Snowden, he said, "Well, I'm not surprised by that, because everybody who sets foot on an Oliver Stone set ends up as an extra." He said that's the way he increases production value.
Got it.
But he was at dinner with these historians, and we were sitting around this really huge, long table, and there were probably about a dozen people around it, and he was engaging in simultaneous arguments about different subjects with like four or five different people. And he and Kuznick were arguing about who was the greater founding father, Thomas Jefferson or Alexander Hamilton. And at one point, Stone stood up and leaned over the table and jabbed a finger at Kuznick and said, "Eat your words, eat your words, motherfucker," and then started laughing.
Wow. Well, right along those lines, Matt, when we write reviews or record reviews, I assume you, like us, like most critics, we don't assume the director is ever going to read it, and that's probably a good thing, but you really are here in dialogue with Stone. You include his comments almost like a director's commentary on a DVD, and as you've said, he is very confrontational, and he's not shy about refuting or questioning your thoughts. So how did that process work, and what was challenging, and what was also rewarding about that?
Well, the book is, you know, I described the book to him, and I described it in the introduction as an Oliver Stone movie about Oliver Stone in the form of a book. And one aspect of that is trying to find a way to capture the sort of jagged, prismatic, free associative editing style of a lot of his movies. And so there's information that's being delivered simultaneously in different levels. There's the running text. The main text is this long interview with Stone. And then there's a kind of a second related book happening with the images. Like, the images are tied to whatever we're discussing, but in some cases they're complicating or questioning some of the things he's saying, like particularly in the section where I kind of interrogate him on his portrait of women in his early films. And then there's yet another movie, as it were, happening in the footnotes where I've got like these really ridiculous, they're ridiculous. The footnotes are ridiculous. I mean, I've got like every single thing that every name, every place that he mentions gets a footnote.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in theory, like my editor said, I don't think it's necessary to have a footnote for Tom Cruise. and I said, yeah, but we've gone this far.
You well, know, and even in some
like,
of...
I was so demented, I was so deranged by the end of this thing that I was thinking, like, I was picturing the Burgess Meredith character from The Twilight Zone, like, sitting in the wreckage of a public library and discovering the Oliver Stone experience, like, 100 years from now, and coming across the part where he talks about Tom Cruise and going, who's that? And it's like, oh, here's a footnote.
Well, it is nice to have, you know, yes, Tom Cruise probably doesn't need it, but that context of what else was going on outside of the immediate conversation you're having with Stone at the moment.
Yeah, and as to your question, though, there are footnotes in the book where Oliver argues with me, where he mm-hmm. argues with my interpretations of things, or he simply flat out says, like, you didn't understand that movie, Matt, or you're full of or whatever. And that came about because I went over the book. You know, the book went through two or three different iterations before it actually shipped off to the press, and I showed it to him. Because he'd been so generous with his time, and it just, you know, I didn't want it to go to press without him looking at it. And when he took issue with things, like, if there were certain things that he wanted redacted that I thought were necessary to the story, or rather deleted, instead of deleting them, I would redact them.
Yeah, that's
and
a great touch.
And there, so there's redactions all through the book, not a lot, but here and there. And also, there were some cases where I wanted to delete things, and he said, you can't delete that. I think that's crucial to the story. It's like, and I'm like, no, it's not. And so I would redact that. And there were a few cases where the publisher said, I think you should redact that thing he just said there because I think we might get sued. So, you know, that's a redaction. And the footnotes where he's arguing with me, it was because he took issue with interpretations. Like, if he had a factual issue, like a correction of something, or if I got a date wrong, or I thought he was talking about a particular guy named Steve and he was talking about a different one, obviously I would just make those changes. But there were places where, like, I had some complaints about aspects of his movies. Like, I don't care very much for Wall Street 2. I thought that Any Given Sunday, while it's very entertaining, is a kind of a fragmented film. I thought Talk Radio had a very strong kind of liberal political dimension, which he completely denies, which I think is bizarre because, I mean, I don't understand how he could say that that's not a political movie, that it's just a character portrait. Anyway, rather than, and I said, I'm not going to change that because that's my opinion. Like, I'm not going to change my opinion. And he's like, you should because it's wrong. And it's like, no, it's not wrong. So I ended up, because the tape recorder was running the entire time, I just transcribed his objections and turned those into footnotes.
Okay.
So you do have this weird, like, the subject of the book is badgering the author all the way through the book. But I feel like that also works, you know, like that's also a kind of a Stone-like thing.
You know, I've used that line, you're so wrong, you should change your opinion with Josh a million times and it doesn't go anywhere
no,
either.
No, it doesn't work for him.
Yeah.
Matt, you are in a perfect position having lived with this material and this man and this filmmaker for the past 6 years or so, but you're also maybe because of that in a terrible position to actually be forced to come up with five scenes that for you define his work or define your relationship to his work. I don't know how you approached it, so let's find out. How did you approach coming up with these five scenes, and what's your number five?
Well, I thought about, it's really hard to choose. I went ahead and chose scenes that are a little bit quieter. They're a little bit quieter. Like, I didn't choose, like, he's very good with, like, battle scenes and scenes of intense violence and scenes of, you know, torture and deprivation and people trying to survive in horrendous circumstances and stuff like that. Like, but I feel like the intense Oliver Stone is pretty well represented, and that's what most people think of when they think of him. They think of, like, an incredibly intense experience. Mm-hmm. So the five that I chose were what I think are more illustrative of him as a person, of his values and of his personality. And so we're moving through this chronologically. One of the ones that I've quoted most often when I've been doing interviews about this book is this one from Platoon. Chris Taylor, who is the hero of Platoon, played by Charlie Sheen, is basically Oliver Stone. He's a young man, well off from a well-off family. And about midway through the movie, we learned that he enlisted, like unlike almost everybody else in his platoon who was drafted, he enlisted. He involuntarily enlisted. And he's telling this other GI played by Keith David why he did that. And it cuts right to the heart of Oliver Stone describing himself as, quote, a traitor to my class, which is a phrase that was attributed to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And I don't know if FDR attributed that to himself or if that's what other people described him as, but this idea of this guy who came from multiple generations of an old money family basically allying himself with the poor and creating all these programs that would later be known as the New Deal. Stone sees himself as, to some extent, a traitor to his own class. He was a rich kid. He grew up the son of a Republican stockbroker. And he was raised by nannies and butlers and stuff. But he enlisted in Vietnam after he wrote this novel. He wrote this novel called A Child's Night Dream, which he hoped was going to set the literary world on fire. And it was rejected. And he was so depressed that he enlisted in Vietnam, partly, as he puts it, because he says he had a death wish, like he was hoping that he would get killed over there. But also because he didn't like the idea that almost all of the people who were serving as enlisted men were working class to poor people. And as he put it, a lot of black folks and rednecks were making up a lot of the armed forces during that conflict. And so as a rich kid, he felt like he needed to enlist. And he could have gone to he probably could have gone to officer school. He probably could have got a cushy assignment where he was nowhere near the action. But he wanted infantry. He wanted to be on the front lines. Mm-hmm. And so that's the scene with Chris Taylor.
Hey, Taylor. How in the f*** you get here anyway? Hey, you look educated.
I volunteered for it.
You did what?
I volunteered. I dropped out of college and told him I wanted the infantry, combat, and Vietnam.
You volunteered for this shit, man?
You believe that?
He was a crazy f***. Giving up college?
Make much sense. I wasn't learning anything. I figured, why should just the poor kids go off to war and the rich kids always get away with it?
Oh, I see. What we got here is a crusader.
Sounds like it.
Shit. You gotta be rich in the first place to think like that.
Yeah, that's a really memorable one for me.
There's some good stuff in the book, too, Matt, where Stone talks about seeing Sheen, the actor, also as maybe not a doppelganger, but, you know, coming. He was a Hollywood kid, too. And so having somewhat of a similar background and bringing that to the film, that was some good background you got him to talk about there.
Yeah, he was disappointed in Charlie Sheen, and he kind of flat out admits to me that he made a mistake latching on to Charlie Sheen. He thinks he was good. He likes him in Platoon and Wall Street. He thinks he did a good job for him. But I think at the beginning he saw him as an alter ego in the way that Scorsese saw De Niro as an alter ego. And it became clear to him fairly soon that, A, Sheen didn't have that kind of versatility, and B, if he did have the potential to be that versatile, he wasn't willing to apply himself in the way that a great actor should. Hmm. And as he put it, you know, Charlie was mainly interested in money.
Well, there's a great connection in that scene, too, to the movie that we discussed earlier in the show, Born on the 4th of July, having just rewatched that Chris Taylor explanation was very much in my mind in the scenes, for example, at the Bronx VA, where the African-American orderly, one of those men, is saying this is a rich man's war. And of course, Cruz's character, Ron Kovic, just has to laugh. And he says, where's my money then? But they're similar, right? They're similar characters in that they're both men who volunteered for something they sacrificed personally based on an ideal, but completely different ideals. I mean, Ron Kovic, at least the character we see in Born on the 4th of July, we can't imagine that he ever considered what Chris Taylor was considering, the plight of African-American men in the country and the disparity between social classes.
No, he certainly wouldn't have. And in fact, Stone talks about this a little bit in the book. He wrote a sequel of sorts to Platoon that was basically about what happens to this character when he comes back home. I mean, not the exact same character, but a character like Chris Taylor in Platoon, but he never produced it. And he said he never feels any need to, because Born on the 4th of July is Ron Kovic's story, and Ron Kovic is a working class guy. And he said he found the personality, the worldview, the mentality of a working class guy to be more interesting than his own perspective, which is that of a rich kid from Manhattan. So that's why he was moved by Kovic's story, because Kovic had that kind of authenticity that Stone aspired to have when he was a younger man. And he could never actually have that. He could only pretend to it. But that movie, Born on the 4th of July, is ultimately probably my favorite Oliver Stone film. I think that's a perfect film. And it paints in extremely broad brushstrokes, and a lot of his movies do on purpose. But I think in terms of its narrative architecture and its symbolic architecture, it's perfectly constructed. Mm-hmm. And it's a movie that I think would go very well on a double bill, not just with Platoon, but also with A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah,
because A Clockwork Orange is the story of a person who is being forcefully deprogrammed and turned into someone else. And you get a sense of the culture that shaped this guy, you know, that created the mentality that you see before you. And that whole scene where they do the Ludovico technique on him, like, I feel like that's one of the inspirations for the entire idea of Born on the Fourth, which starts out steeped in this nostalgic, patriotic, Norman Rockwell kind of apple pie, waving flags, fireworks kind of imagery. You know, he's hitting the game-winning home run. It's like, you know, I think Pauline Kael said, like, it's, you're almost getting nostalgia overload and the credits aren't even over yet. And then he deconstructs that. Like, he shows the sinister underbelly of all of this iconography. And one of my favorite bits later in the movie is when he returns home and he's in his wheelchair, they take him to a 4th of July parade in 1970 in Massapequa, and he's suffering from PTSD, and he zones out on the podium when he's supposed to be giving a speech. And there's a shot of the American flag, and it's transparent. The sun is behind it, and you're literally seeing through the flag, like, which is a very Eisensteinian kind of shot.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And that also has one of my very favorite scenes, probably my favorite scene in that entire movie.
Well, let's get to it. That's your number four, right?
Yeah. One of my favorite scenes in that entire movie is when Ronnie comes home. His dad helps him out of the car, and the neighbors and his family turn out to greet him. And they, one after the other, they say the same thing to him, which is, Ronnie,
you look great.
You look great.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Ronnie. How are you, man? You look good.
Yeah,
hey, Ronnie.
You feel great.
Good.
Ronnie, welcome home. You look so good. It's so good to see you.
Hey,
look at him. He looks great.
Harry, look at Harry. You look good.
Welcome home, Ron.
Hi, Ronnie.
Let's go in the house and help.
And you can tell they don't mean it. They don't know what to say, yeah.
And it's like, what else are you going to say? What else are you going to say to him? And what else is he going to say but, thank you, I love you, I'm glad to see you, and other pleasantries? But it's all a lie. And he talks about, in a subsequent scene, not maybe a few minutes after that in the movie, when he has his drunken breakdown and starts yelling at his mother, he's talking about the lies. And he says, it's lies. It's all lies. You know, like the lie of the war, the lie of the patriotic obligation. And that connects really well with my favorite sequence in JFK, which is the scene between Jim Garrison, who's trying to break open the Kennedy conspiracy, and this mysterious military-industrial complex representative known only as X, played by Donald Sutherland. And Sutherland sits there and lays out all these different scenarios. He doesn't actually spell out a conspiracy. He merely presents what he knows and spins some possibilities. But one of the things he says is that the primary purpose of a society is to prepare its members for war, to prepare them to go off willingly for war. And when I see that scene now, it makes me think of the scene in Born on the 4th of July, where a Marine recruiter, interestingly played by Tom Berenger, who was the Scarface sergeant in Platoon, comes to Ron Kovic's school and starts talking about the sites of the great battles of the United States Marine Corps, you know, including Iwo Jima and the Frozen Chosen Reservoir in Korea, and says, you know, first to fight and fills him up with this desire to get in there and get some of that glory. And that's part of, I guess, what you would call the Oliver Stone expanded universe.
Yeah.
You know, he really creates a whole, he has a worldview and he has a world that he creates, and I think he sustains it from film to film.
The organizing principle of any society, Mr. Garrison, is for war. The authority of the state over its people resides in its war powers. And Kennedy wanted to end the Cold War in his second term. He wanted to call off the moon race in favor of cooperation with the Soviets. He signed a treaty with the Soviets to ban nuclear testing. He refused to invade Cuba in 1962, and he set out to withdraw from Vietnam. But all of that ended on the 22nd November, 1963.
You know, the scene you chose from JFK with X is interesting because it is a quiet one. You mentioned you wanted to choose quiet ones, but watching it again, there is also a lot of that almost subliminal editing going on that happens a lot throughout JFK, but here's a scene where it's much more subtle because it's just two guys talking, and yet we'll get these flashes of historical documentary footage and then some manipulated footage as well to underline what X is saying. As you said, not in a step A to step B manner, but just peppering us, you know, peppering us with possibilities. And that is enough to crack open and make us wonder. And I really think for me, you know, you talked about coming to Stone's films during the 80s, I do remember understanding at that point that Platoon was an important picture, but JFK was about the time, I would have been in high school then, where it really challenged me to do the work of a cinephile because of how it was constructed in that way. And what's interesting about JFK too is, you know, I remember also giving the impression that this was a crackpot movie, right? This was a guy who was selling us something that most of the world didn't believe. So I went into it with my guard up. And in a way, that forced me to pay more attention and to think, okay, what is this guy doing with editing, with film stock, with camera vantage points, and really realizing what went into making a picture? And yeah, that scene you picked is just a good example of how he managed to do that in almost every moment of JFK.
Well, and particularly in that sequence, which, as he told me in the book, was originally two scenes. There was one that occurred roughly at the same place that you now see it in the finished film, and then there was another one that occurred at the end. It was almost like a wrap-up, you know, like there was a second visit with X. And he, when he put together the rough cut, he realized that it hurt the momentum of the film to have two scenes with X, so he had to go back and figure out a way to combine the two. And it was very difficult to do that. But the result, it's kind of dazzling. It's almost like a film within a film. And I think it's the high point of the entire movie, that and the whole back and to the left sequence in the courtroom where he deconstructs the Zapruder film and recreates the assassination on location in Dealey Plaza, which it still blows my mind that they allowed him to do that in Dallas. But I think that is, without a doubt, the single greatest sustained exposition dump in the history of cinema, that scene.
Yeah. And just to go back real quick, I can't help myself. You talk about that expanded universe. I love watching Born on the Fourth again and seeing Willem Dafoe playing a variation, a much more sinister variation on the character he plays in Platoon as Elias, in terms of being that character who sort of brings our hero over to another side, so to speak.
Yeah, he does. He does play a very similar part in that movie. And I think Berenger plays a similar part to the one he played in Platoon.
Yeah, without a
you
doubt.
Know, in that, like, one of them is, you know, one's Apollonian and the other's Dionysian. Mm-hmm. And one of them is essentially an extension of the establishment. And the other one is of the establishment, but is turned against it in some basic way.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you see that, reflected. There's pairings like that all the way through his filmography, like all the way up to Savages, where you've got these three young people who are part of this pot collective in California, and a woman and two men, and one of the guys is basically Barnes and the other one's Elias.
Really? That's a movie I haven't seen, but you have me intrigued.
I really like that one. I
Do
know
you?
A lot of people. Yeah, I know that one is not one that people particularly care for the most part, but I really enjoy it as kind of a business black comedy. And in fact, if I were going to program an Oliver Stone Film Festival that was entirely double features, I would pair that one with Wall Street.
Mm. Well, we've heard scenes from three great Oliver Stone films, Platoon, Born on the Fourth, and JFK. We have a couple more picks here. I think next in the chronology would be Natural Born Killers, Matt?
Yeah, Natural Born. Okay, so now this is a scene where Mallory Knox goes to visit Mickey in jail, And this scene really jumped out at me. I hadn't seen the movie on a big screen with an audience until, I mean, I saw it when it came out a couple of times, but I hadn't seen it again with an audience until about 6 months ago or so, when Walter Chaw, who writes for Film Freak Central, he programmed an Oliver Stone crime film festival, which included Scarface, Natural Born Killers, U-Turn, and Savages. And I got to see Natural Born Killers with an audience, and the thing that struck me was how, and this is going to sound really weird, but how tender it was at certain points. Like, that's not an adjective that you associate with that film usually.
No, not at all.
I mean, this is a very, very violent film. It was very controversial. It got in a lot of trouble with the ratings board. They wanted to give it an X for violence and for tone, which is interesting because that was the same complaint that they had against Brian De Palma's Scarface, which Stone wrote. But it's not the movie that maybe we remember it as being. Like, it has this strange kind of sympathy for these criminal characters, these really disreputable, kind of ostracized, demonized characters. And that comes through very, very strongly in this jail scene where Mickey and Mallory are talking, and you hear Bob Dylan playing softly on the soundtrack. And while they're talking, Stone cuts away to all of these other couples, like all of these other people visiting their mates in jail. And he lingers on their faces, and there are people of different races, different ethnicities, and they're all kind of in the same boat as Mickey and Mallory. Fly the ocean in a silver plane. See the jungle in its wet with rain. Just remember till you're home again, you belong. It's really lovely. I was really touched by it. And that's not, again, like not the reaction that you necessarily expect to have when you see something like Natural Born Killers.
Stone's use of music is interesting because it's often thematically on the nose. I was thinking of this in Heaven and Earth in particular when they get back to the States, but he usually gets the rhythm right, you know, sort of like his editing. The music just moves in the right way for the scene. And I think that's the case in point here in this one from Natural Born Killers.
I think there's something to be said for on-the-nose filmmaking if that's what you're doing. You know, and I would say that Sergei Eisenstein was one of the most on-the-nose filmmakers in the history of cinema, but we celebrate him.
Yeah, and that's absolutely Stone style, right?
Yeah, and, you know, Fellini's about as on-the-nose as you're going to get. I mean, there's a scene in 8 1/2 where the hero is battling different aspects of his relationship with women with a bullwhip. You know, well, Ride of the Valkyries plays on the soundtrack. You know, like, on the there's nothing wrong with on the nose as long as you do it with style and energy. And I think in the case of that Natural Born Killer scene, playing, you know, hearing Bob Dylan singing You Belong to Me over the scenes of these couples bonding in a waiting area of the prison is a beautiful thing. And,
yeah,
you know, like Born on the 4th of July has a lot of cues like that. I mean, I love that sequence before he goes off to Vietnam. You know, he runs
Moon River. It's incredible.
Moon River is
to the
playing.
Dance.
Moon River
yeah.
is great. It's great stuff.
Yeah.
And you hear it echoing over that shot. You know, he embraces Donna and they're on the dance floor and the camera slowly moves away from them. And then it fades out, and then you come in with this pan down on this blasted out orange, which is not a color you expect to see in a Vietnam film,
no,
landscape. And you hear the last, you know, we're after the same rainbow's end. That's all you hear.
It's the carryover there that's really what makes it effective.
Tracks of My Tears, of course, in Platoon, a really great sequence as well.
That's a great song choice. That's a great one, too. And and also in Born on the 4th, when he's... I love, you know, a lot of people have complained about this even at the time, but the use of American Pie when he's in the VA hospital,
mm-hmm,
and he's absolutely in denial about whether or not he's going to walk again. And they say, you're not walking again. He's like, F you, I'm walking. And he's doing this. And boy, did the casting of Tom Cruise really, really, mm-hmm, you know, you never feel more. I bet he never felt more vindicated than when he was watching that sequence because Tom Cruise, like, there's this maniacal willpower to Tom Cruise in a lot of his performances, never more so in that. And when he falls and breaks his leg and the bone pokes through his skin and Don McLean's American Pie is playing, it's like God is mocking him.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is.
That is for me the definitive Tom Cruise moment, because it's taking everything that we knew him to be up until that point, and he's tried to be again afterwards, and turning it inside out, yet using his very determination to do it. So you're right. The casting of him was a masterstroke, and never more so than in that scene.
It's brilliant casting Maverick from Top Gun as this guy gets paralyzed and can't use his penis anymore.
Right.
You know, and who runs around yelling about it to his mother. It's great. It's like that shot in Planet of the Apes where they show, the end, the Statue of Liberty is broken apart.
Yeah.
It's like a desecration of a monument casting Tom Cruise in that part.
Sorry, Matt, I was going to say you can't say penis on this show.
You've crossed the line, sir.
It's just like Kovic's house. Sorry. So we have rules here. So four great choices. Let's get to your final one. What is it?
So my fifth choice is from Nixon. This is a scene where Richard Nixon, played by Anthony Hopkins, is on the eve of his resignation from the White House after accepting the fact that the Watergate scandal is going to be his undoing. He has no choice. He's going to have to pack it in. And he asks Henry Kissinger. I can't even get through this without laughing. It's really funny and sad. But he asks Henry Kissinger to pray with him. And the idea of asking Henry Kissinger to pray with you is that's ridiculous on its face. Like, I can't think of a person who's less likely to turn to God for help in a moment of crisis. But also the way that Paul Sorvino plays that part, where he's like he's even more of a monotone than usual. He's like, okay, yes.
Let's pray, Henry. Let's pray a little. Just you and me. I hope this doesn't embarrass you, Henry.
No, not at all, no. This is not going to leak, is it?
Don't be too proud, Henry. Never be too proud to go on your knees before God.
It is. It is a great scene, and it is one of those scenes that catches you totally off guard, because you just can't imagine that even in that moment, and we've seen him exhibit a lot of, let's say, tone-deaf behavior, Nixon the character, and that one just seems to be the pinnacle of it.
Well, and Sorvino he had me cracking up too, because he's so uncomfortable, first about the very idea of prayer, then about having to get down on his knees. And then once Nixon starts blubbering, that's like it for him. He doesn't know how to deal with this show of emotion, and seeing him in the background struggling with this, it does make it a moment of pathos and also comedy at the same time.
It's great, and it's also it contradicts a perception of Stone that has lingered for some reason, which is that he doesn't have a sense of humor. He totally has a sense of humor. I mean, some of his movies are funny. They're just not funny in a way that's socially acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And Natural Born Killers is, of course, a great example of that. But another one is U-Turn, which, in my opinion, is one of the great American comedies of the 90s. I mean, that's like a purgatorial comedy, essentially. I mean, this guy, it's the Hotel California. He can check in, but he can never leave. Like, his car breaks down. He just wants to get his car repaired and get out of town. But one damn thing after another keeps happening to this guy. And by the end of it, the vultures are about to eat his flesh.
Yeah. Yeah. I hadn't really thought about the screwball comedy sense of that movie, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
So great scenes there, great choices. I know you considered at least a couple more. Any honorable mentions that you want to throw out?
Yeah, I'd like to throw out a scene from Heaven and Earth, which is a really good, really interesting movie that I think is due for reappreciation. That's the third film in his Vietnam series. Came out in 1993, a couple of years after JFK. And in fact, he took all of the clout that he had accumulated from JFK, which was one of his top grossing films and was nominated for a bunch of Oscars. And he plowed it into making a 2.5-hour movie about a Vietnamese woman who survives unbelievable trauma over the course of many years in Vietnam and then settles in the United States with her GI husband, played by Tommy Lee Jones. And he cast a newcomer, Hip Thie Lee, as the main character, which was, I still can't believe he did that. I still can't believe that happened. And it's nothing like it has ever happened since. And I think it's a beautiful film, and it's also in many ways, it's a religious film. This was a film that was made when he was essentially becoming a Buddhist. And he was, or as he puts it, a student of Buddhism. He bristles whenever I describe him as a Buddhist because he feels like he's not entitled to call himself that. Like, he feels like it's insufficiently humble to call himself that. But there's a moment in that that I think is a great example of Stone's ability as a social satirist, and that is this. And he's seeing the world through the eyes of a Vietnamese woman who grew up as a peasant. She came from a farm family. She lived in a world of jungle trees and rice paddies and rivers, and here she comes to the American suburbs, and she gets a sense of how people live here. And it is a devastating caricature of what passes for American values. And you see a meal that's being prepared, and it consists entirely of food that's been frozen and canned and packed full of preservatives. And the soundtrack in this thing is metal grinding and gas stoves springing to life, and it's machines.
Now, maybe take a little more work, but we've got that under control. Isn't that magic?
You know, it's basically him saying, like, we have... The American machine extends to food.
Yeah.
It's not just war. It's not just consumerism. Like, even the way we eat is completely mechanical and devoid of feeling. And it's a kind of corrosive portrait of a society. In just a few brisk brushstrokes, that sequence only lasts a couple of minutes, but it reminds me again of something out of Luis Buñuel, who is one of Stone's heroes.
Well, there's that moment where I think it's the steak comes right out of the freezer, and I believe it's Tommy Lee Jones' character's sister-in-law acts like this is a problem, right? It's frozen. What are we going to do? And then she shows her, we'll just put it in this other machine. And she opens, I don't know what it is, but some sort of small oven, tosses it in, presses a button, and it starts heating up. And yeah, that is a good sequence. I did just see Heaven and Earth this past week for the first time, and it didn't resonate with me as much as I had hoped it would have. So I'm looking forward to reading that section of the book, Matt. I haven't gotten there yet where Stone talks about Heaven and Earth, because that's one thing I have appreciated about it is just this other vantage point that he offers on his pictures and that you draw out of him too. And the Buddhism element is one that I was trying to get a handle on and just get a better sense of how that informed her story. So I'll be looking forward to reading that section.
Yeah, she meditates her way through the worst of life in that movie. And I think he portrays that really well. Like, you see her drawing strength from her family members and from her ancestors, and that's where that kind of JFK flash cut editing,
yes,
gets applied to a different purpose. And he uses it again to yet another purpose in Any Given Sunday, where, you know, that you have that great sequence with Jamie Foxx, the quarterback, coming over to the coach Al Pacino's house to talk about his bad attitude, and it ends up being this little kind of race relations summit. Well, Ben-Hur is playing on a television, and he's cutting between Ben-Hur, which is, of course, about slaves, and the conversation between Pacino and Jamie Foxx. And he also flash cuts in images from football's past, like in the first half of the century when most of the players were white. So there's like three different layers of commentary happening in that scene.
Brother has to know his place, right, boss?
I don't understand what you're talking. What are you talking about?
You don't trust anybody because of what happened to you in college? Come on, Willie. You knew the rules. You were the one that broke them.
Broke them?
Yeah.
How'd I break them?
How'd you break them?
You broke them.
That's how you
lost a $1 million signing bonus because I took a $300 suit from a booster to go to this kid's wedding. I didn't even know the guy. What is a brother supposed to do when he in college? Huh? He ain't got no money. He want to go out on a date. Want to get some nice clothes. Everybody had their hands out, but it was me they suspended.
Those are Matt Zollersites' top five Oliver Stone scenes. Matt's book, The Oliver Stone Experience, is available now. Look for it wherever you buy books. Matt, we have been looking forward to having you on the show for some time now, and it was a lot of fun. Hope you can come back sometime.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
Best of luck with the book.
Take care.
All you do is talk at me, man. So I'm going to stay who I am, Steaming Willie Beam. And with the time I got left, I'm going to play my way, get my dollars up. So when you go to waive me, trade me, injury reserve me, or whatever the f*** y'all do, I'll be worth 10 times what I was worth before I got here.
Our thanks again to Matt for that conversation. We look forward to your comments and your top five Oliver Stone scenes. You can email us anytime, feedback@filmspotting.net.
If email isn't your thing, try leaving us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. If you missed that number, it's under the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Adam is at Filmspotting. I'm at Larson on Film. And at filmspotting.net, you can find 11 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. If you haven't already, also check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
Out in limited release this weekend, The Dressmaker, an Australian revenge tale with Kate Winslet, Judy Davis, and Hugo Weaving. Goat, a fraternity hazing movie with James Franco and Nick Jonas. And My Blind Brother, here's the description, Josh. Love for the same woman causes conflict between an overachieving blind athlete and the brother who made him that way.
I knew brothers like that in high school.
Mm-hmm. Of course. And of course, that's a comedy with Adam Scott, Jenny Slate, and Nick Kroll. Out in wide release, Storks, the animated comedy that's co-directed by Doug Sweetland of Pixar's Presto fame, and Nicholas Stoller, who gave us Neighbors and Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and The Magnificent Seven, starring Denzel Washington, Chris Pratt, Ethan Hawke, Peter Sarsgaard. It's directed by Antoine Fuqua, and that is going to give us our theme for next week's show. No, not another filmmaker centered episode, but an actor centered episode. We're going to talk about The Magnificent Seven, and we're going to share our top five Denzel Washington performances.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Our music this week was by Dawes. You can get more information at DawesTheBand.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Oh, great. Igor Drilaka.
Igor Drilaka.
Drilaka. Drilaka.
Yeah.
Comes from the Sarajevo-born, Toronto-based Igor Drilaka. Drilaka.
Sure.
Drilaka.
Yeah.
I think the third one, I got it right.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.